Welcome to Seize the GM, a show about how to seize the GM's seat and run with it. I'm your host, Zendead.
I'm your co-host, Jules.
And I'm the other co-host, Null Operations.
Have you ever had a great idea for a campaign? Do you have a bunch of friends who want to play an RPG but have no one to run it? You want to see what the world is like behind the GM screen instead of in front of it?
Well, we're here to help you do just that. Each week, the three of us are going to discuss various GMing topics. Terminology, maps, atmosphere, world building, you name it. So sit back, relax, and let's hit that GM seat hard. Banter, banter, banter.
You know what we need to do?
And I'll
bring this part in. What we need to do is we need to have you just say like segment openings that you could just drop in as you're editing, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe with little musical cues in the background. Or something quirky and cute. And that's my starting banter.
So oh, me God. Being silly on a microphone. Like, I don't do that enough already.
We do a podcast, so.
Or in some cases, more than one. So what have you guys been up to this week?
Oh, couple things. Fixing up websites. Trying to kill my player characters. We'll get to that later. And writing.
Nice.
Awesome. Awesome. For Sunday, we went up, visited our DM for D&D, lives up in West Virginia. So we went to his house, and oh my gosh, it was the most awesome game because we moved from room to room where they had different dungeons, part of this dungeon set up, like for real. Like they had, like, you moved your little piece across and it tripped a trap. Like we had our piece of the wall fall down. It was awesome.
That's pretty cool.
Oh, it was epic. And so epic.
Far too deep into the hobby for me.
Oh my God, that's the sort of stuff I love to do.
Yeah, I love it. I'd never seen anything like that, so it's just like,
oh,
I'm playing the Trap Smasher Barbarian, so I'm taking point. I'm like, oh, okay, smash that. And he's like, and as you hit it, and he pushes down on it, and like two parts of the wall fall in. Thing is, they used to work at our local game shop before it closed down, so, you know, over years, they've accumulated all these, and it's kind of like puzzle PC, build your own dungeon. Mm-hmm. But it's really cool looking stuff, like
Dwarven Forge.
I don't know what it is. The thing is, like, the way that it looks, you know, if you look in, oh, nice, you know, pattern on the floor, but it's done up so you have like the little 5-foot squares. It's just it's insane.
Is it resin cast?
I think so.
Yeah, if it is, it's definitely Dwarven Forge.
I think I'm not sure.
Forge has been around since the 80s doing stuff. Yeah, their stuff is so amazingly cool looking.
Yeah, so like after we'd break stuff, she'd pull out a piece and put in like a broken jail cell. She'd pull out one. The doors worked. And what she did is, as we were exploring, she had pretty much John and Nora, they kind of tag team. Nora does like a lot more of the setup. John is the DM. And it's awesome. As we are moving, she's pulling, like, she has this, like, felt cloth over it so we wouldn't see the whole thing all at once. So as we explored rooms, we got reveals. And as we moved in the rooms, the DM was dropping the monsters as we got to see them. And it was one of the coolest things ever.
Yeah.
See, that's one thing I miss about physical campaigns. But one thing I do like about running a digital table.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because you can play with the lighting and how the lighting works. Mm-hmm.
And I can have the entire map there for me to see and just, you know, click and drag this box and now they can see that area.
Yeah, we will definitely go into a thing on that because I've never actually gotten a chance to play with any of those. And I think it would be cool to do at some point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, I don't know. I've been pretty busy this week with just normal life stuff. I got into the game that I was running. We actually got to run it Saturday, and then I'm going to turn around, and we're going to actually get 2 weeks in a row.
Nice!
We went a month between, like, when we first started and then the next time we got to play. So he finally started getting, like, days off, or at least where he's not working until 11 o'clock on a Saturday.
Right.
Because I'm not running until 5 in the morning. I'm just doing it. Not when I have a 4-year-old who wakes me up at 8:30 promptly. And they decided that they were going to, they're building their own tavern. They wanted to have a tavern. And nice. So I'm, okay, cool. You guys spend about 3 weeks because there's a mechanic system in it mm-hmm. where they can just like spend some points, and then they have a tavern. And I'm like, okay, it takes about 3 weeks to do this. So cool. Here it is. You guys have your tavern. And my wife is like, I want to build the tavern, like for reals.
Nice.
And I'm like, kick ass. So yeah, we're going to build it all out of wood for the flooring and stain it and everything. So it'll be just like you're describing. It'll be their tavern.
Nice.
And I want to build little LED lights underneath that will be in the fireplaces. Flick the lights on and it'll flicker inside the fireplaces.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
So, yeah. So, because I'm going to build a... Well, and that kind of went seamlessly into what are you running? And I am running Pathfinder, damn it. I'm just going to keep going. Keep talking.
Nice.
They finally just got through like the beginning part of it, and it was all like social. It was all interaction, like just character interactions. They got to a point where they're like, well, we need to find a guide. So they were like, okay, well, let's look around. Let's ask around. So they asked this one woman who's kind of sponsoring them, and they asked her, you know, hey, do you guys know of a guide that might be able to show us or tell us how to move around in this swamp that we're going to go to? And she's like, oh, yes, I totally know a guy. He's over here, but he's not really stable. So my wife's playing a cleric, and she figured out that he's suffering from schizophrenia. And she's like, well, can I heal him? I'm like, well, go ahead and give me a roll. So she makes the roll, and she's like, I'm like, yeah, you can totally do it. These are the things, these are the spells that you need to do it. You know what spells would work. She's like, okay, cool.
That's pretty neat.
She needed to have, like, it's like 4 or 5 spells that would cure the schizophrenia. And so she's like, well, I can't cast any of these yet. And I'm like, well, you know that, you know, a temple might have them, or maybe there's like a physician's guild or an apothecary might have the stuff to do it. And she goes, okay, okay. And so she tells her compatriot in crime, literally, because he's the rogue. And he goes, oh, I'll just go steal them.
Oh, boy.
Okay, I'm going to start doing this. And I'm like, okay, we're stopping here because I don't have that plan. And this is totally out of left field, guys. So we're going to stop. We'll pick it up next week. So I've been like doing the figuring out like the place that they're going to break into and everything. And I'm like, okay, yeah, this is cool. So it's like almost like a sick ward. It's an apothecary and naturalists guild.
Nice.
And they also run a sick ward for like the poor downtrodden. And then there's also like special rooms up on top for like nobility and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That they get their private room. And so I'm like, well, they've got to have like a lab where they can store all of this. And I'm like, well, they no reasonable like group that's worried about saving people is going to have traps that kill. That's just stupid. So I had to come up with a spell that would, so like a trap basically that would work for them without killing the invader.
Can I offer you a suggestion?
Oh, I already figured it out. Deep slumber.
That works too, but you know what you should also have?
What?
Anti-undead traps. That basically designed to take out anybody who would try to be trying to feed on weak people. Ineffective and harmless to the player characters, but funny.
Oh, they may have stuff like that laying that there's in there, but like there's like a caretaker, and there's always at least a few like physician type in there to, you know, to take care of the sick and dying. I think it's going to be pretty awesome when he does it next week, and I'm just like, yes. And then they're going to like, my wife's like, well, what, you know, let me go ahead and make the roll now, so we can just storyboard. We don't have to worry about rolling dice. I said, well, it's only really one roll. And I said, and the bigger problem with it is that the guy that's stealing it can't read magic. So he has to guess. She's like, well, he has a price. He can identify it. I said, no, no, no. He can tell you how much it's worth if he could read it. And she's like, oh. I'm like, but you have read magic, so it's okay. You can figure out what it is. She goes, well, I don't want to leave them high and dry with nothing. I said, well, there'll be potions and other things that they will be able to use. And none of these are like super high level spells except for one, because they actually have a heal spell. well, that's a pretty high level spell, but they need it. And it's like one dude there can cast it. And they're like, well, how much would it cost? I'm like, it's about a 1500 gold piece scroll at least. And they're like, well, I don't want to spend that much money.
So wow. Much for the greater good.
Well, they're not necessarily good. They're more neutrally aligned. So I'm just like, wow. But he's doing, you know, like the rogue is like chaotic neutral. And he's just like.
And we can definitely have a talk about alignment down the road.
Oh, yeah, we will. But we will.
Just doing an equal amount of good and bad things doesn't make you chaotic neutral.
Oh, no. No. And he knows it. He was just being ridiculous.
Okay.
But. So what are you running, Justin?
Well, still continuing the D&D Final Fantasy campaign, and threw the Dragon Hammer at my players. Now, I should mention that they are a party of four, who are all around level 8 or 9, I believe, and so I threw a level 20 dragon at them. An ancient dragon at that. I, of course, did not expect them to survive this encounter should they attempt to best this dragon on their own.
Well, wait a second. Was it undead? And did they have a whole bunch of Phoenix Downs?
No. I mean, to be fair, yes, it is a Final Fantasy campaign, and that's a good point. Instead, I took the narrative approach to get them out of trouble, in that I wanted the dragon to be more of a barrier to them getting into this keep that they finally, basically, they're underground, they're crossing this giant stone bridge, there's a river of lava far below, there's the surface way up there, there's this stone keep in front of them that has this crystal that they've been trying to secure. And the dragon is, of course, the guardian of the crystal. So nice. As they're getting ready to face off the dragon because they're like, I don't want to do this, the airship comes down and opens fire on the dragon.
Deus ex machina.
Well, it's just a matter of timing, actually. Because it's not a hero coming to save them. It was actually the first antagonist they met in the first dungeon where they kind of started off this whole quest. She's back trying to get the crystal for herself.
Nice!
So, the session ends still in combat. However, the dragon is currently crawling over the underside of the airship trying to rip it apart. So he's off dealing with that for the next, I think 5 rounds I'm going to give them. And they need to make it across the bridge, figure out the puzzle at the entrance to the keep, and then get inside before the dragon comes back. Because if that dragon comes back once he's done with that little paper airship, essentially, well, he is a level 20 dragon, and they're only level 8 or 9.
There will be nothing good about that.
The fun part is what we did for the first hour of the session. I'm very light in terms of giving them magical artifacts, things like that.
Sure.
Because in the setting, you know, it's fun fantasy, so you have materia and all that. So I let them play with these two machines that let them take their existing masterwork and magical items and change them into different magic items. I even let them use the magic item compendium as a guidebook in terms of what they could change into. So basically, they went from having a few kind of, you know, no-throws magical items and weapons to having some pretty cool gear, and they also kind of surprised me with that stuff. And in the middle of them doing this, Cameron, the ranger in the group, goes, you know, we're getting all this cool stuff. I bet we're about to have a boss battle. I'm like, I'm not saying anything because you'll find out in an hour.
Yeah, right. Nice.
Good times.
All right. Jules, what are you running?
Now, currently I'm not running anything, but I'm getting some folks together for a new Little Fears campaign. I now have all 3 of the source books, and after everyone's been reading them, they're like, ooh, I want to. One of them is like the missing children, you know, children that are forgotten in the world, and the other one is the blessed type of children, using bunny rabbit ears around blessed, because nothing's always all good.
Right.
So they want to make different types of characters. So right now, because of like the nature of the game, and it can be like super fun, like Goonies meets Are You Afraid of the Dark? It can get really honking dark. So
interesting,
like,
interesting combination.
Yeah, well, it's the last time I ran this with certain people, it's the set it up for a perfect scene, and then you know, like the big, like, kind of denouement happens and just nobody's moving, nobody's breathing. And I'm like, oh, I got them right where I want them. Go me. You know, frozen. Nice. And it was beautiful. And it wasn't even with just like, oh, spooky. It was just object terror when they realized what they did. So, you know, and I like that. The system is so simple, and it allows for a lot of creative freedom. And because a lot of the people I play with are really good, it's just like we joke about it. It's like, yeah, we'll come up with a concept, but then we pull everything else out of our asses. And with this, it works because it's based around kind of like, you know, that childhood imagination. So yeah. That whole stream of consciousness, you know, I've got pretty much a basic idea of what we're doing and, you know, some of the bad things, you know, like highlights, you know, like spotlight scenes that I can find so many ways to get there. That's what I love. So hopefully we'll be able to get together and play, but with everyone's schedules, it's getting tough. So crossing my fingers.
The whole grown-up thing, it sucks.
I know, adulting, it's so difficult.
Segue on to the main topic, which is first campaigns and settings. And like the system that they use and everything. So, Justin, let's start with you. What was the first thing you played in?
So my first thing I ever played in was, it was basically simple AD&D 2nd Edition. We had a box set in the early 90s. First time playing was, I think, 93, summer of. And a little backstory for that. Where that kind of came from was my father had gotten remarried to a teacher or a professor at the University of New Orleans. They ran a summer program for kids called Sparkle. And one of the classes they ran was a basics of role-playing class, which my older brother Lyle was in. He was so enthralled by the kind of system they had. It wasn't D&D, it was some homebrew thing. But he was so enthralled by it and the books that he had seen at the class that he convinced our grandmother to buy the Advances of Dragons 2nd Edition rulebooks for Player's Handbook, Monster Manual, Dungeon Master Guide, box set, and the Dragonstrike VHS tape and get us playing it.
Okay, now hold on. Dragonstrike?
Mm-hmm. So, are you familiar with this?
What the hell is Dragonstrike?
I take that as a no. Okay. So, Dragonstrike. Best way to describe it, it's like D&D 2nd Edition Extra Light. It takes a lot of the concepts of Dungeons & Dragons. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's still a TSR product. And kind of throws you this kind of campaign book and two nice little maps that became like, you know, two of the three maps we always used. Cheap little figurines. And this VHS tape for this 30-minute movie that kind of took you to the basics of running a game and being a dungeon master. And it's awesome. It's fun. It's a little cheesy. It's a little aged, but it's fun.
Better than Kung Fury, I hope.
Yeah, I introduced that to somebody 2 days ago.
They'll probably haven't forgiven you yet.
As well you should.
But it was a lot of fun. And actually, you know, we talked a little bit about some things before the podcast, and I realized Dragonstrike is where I got the little plastic figurines from. The box set only had paper figurines.
Okay. Ah!
I was right!
You were right.
I owned that box set. That's why I remember it. And I'm like, I thought there were figures, but I don't... Maybe there weren't. It was a long time ago.
To be fair, though, we also used those figurines, and we also picked up a set of the Heroes of the Lance pewter figurines.
Oh, nice.
Sweet.
Nice.
So basically, the pewter figurines would often be our main characters. The plastic figurines would be like NPCs that, you know, were allies. Everything else was paper.
Nice. Now, okay. You said the Dragon Strike... Okay, so apparently this video is still on YouTube.
Yep.
Okay.
Oh, we should inflict it on everyone. Oh, yes.
We are going to link to this because I am going to watch it and next by next episode. And next episode, I am that is going to be my bantering subject.
Perfect.
Just
perfect.
So you know. Because this is kind of the way we're thinking about doing this show is we're going to have every like 3 or 4 episodes is going to be is centered around an idea and a theme. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things. Like, this is early beginning, what you need, how to get things started, where we all came from. So you get kind of an idea of some of the different things that were out there when each of us started.
Mm-hmm.
So you played in this, and so it was kind of like a homebrewed.
Yeah, we never
venture.
There was stuff in the Dragon Strike box and the second edition box, but we never jumped on any of the settings. In fact, the only exposure I had to D&D settings in general was through the books. Aside from that, we never picked up adventure modules. We never picked up pre-made dungeons. So, you know, while at first it was my oldest brother, running the game, within a month, I had taken up the DM seat a bit and started running just homebrew games.
That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so Jules, what was the first thing you played in?
Well, tabletop, it was the old Star Wars D6 with the super happy fun die. Played a nice. Twi'lek bounty hunter.
Nice. Sweet.
And, you know, we started playing it, you know, a little bit more seriously. And the thing is, the game, oh gosh, after a couple months, turned from being, you know, like this kind of like Star Wars epic-y thing to it curved off into absolutely absurd because of that stupid super happy fun die. You know, we had a guy in, it was like this powered armor, like incredible, and he rolled a 1 on the super happy fun die twice, and he developed like a psychological dependency on it. So when he wasn't in it, he'd pretty much freak out and lose his mind, kind of a thing. He got himself stuck in a trash can one time because it felt closer to the power armor. The thing is, like, it turned to the absurd, but it wasn't due to any fault of the GM or anything else. It's that super happy fun die. And if you roll a 6 on the super happy fun die and it keeps exploding, and for absolutely no reason, you're able to guess the password on the security system, the weapon security systems on a Star Destroyer. And it's all like die Ewoks, die, exclamation point. Kind of a goofy thing. So it was a lot of fun. And I think it was a sophomore in college. So holy moly, we were just, oh God. that's the one thing when you have that kind of insanity with a randomness die, you know, and it happens a lot more frequently. I mean, everyone can roll a 1 on a d20 or a 20, but rolling a 1 on a d6 and a 6 on a d6 is a lot more frequent.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Not to go too much off topic, but I've always loved the concept of the random die that affects things, not even like skill test. When we were running a test of a homebrew RPG system, I had a player running a kind of a AI construct, and anytime the player characters asked him to do something, he would have to roll a random personality die.
Is it that time?
It made for good times.
Interesting. Now, there's something that's very interesting that I just realized. So, Jules, you said you were a sophomore in college when you started playing?
Mm-hmm. I started LARPing beforehand. That was my first foray into RPGs at all. But, you know, until I got to college, I'd read the books, but there was no one to play with. And the second half of my freshman year, we already had the Maryland LARP Society way, you know, but there was no like official college gaming club. So we started one, and it was all different types of, you know, card games and board games and RPGs, and people were testing out, you know, like ideas. But the first like real, you know, RPG was the Star Wars D6. So I started LARPing before I started tabletop, which is kind of weird.
Well, given the time frame, it actually isn't that weird. So, Justin, how old were you when you started?
I was 9.
Okay.
When I was gaming, game mastering, so.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I lived in Yuppiesville, Central USA, so you played RPGs or read comics, you...
Yeah.
So, yeah. There weren't a lot of my kind, and I'm using bunny rabbit ears around that, you know, the geeks and the freaks and the nerds, you know. Everyone was, like, really smart, but they had it in that jock kind of sense.
Yeah.
So, until I got to college, I'm like, there's the astronomy club and the physics club. These guys are nuts. My people.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then what was the first thing that you actually started running, Jules?
First thing I started running actually was Little Fears. Believe it or not, I had, it happens, especially in LARPs and certain other tabletop games where you're told, you would suck at this, you know. So I always had all right, I'll be the player, I'll play. And I always had this feeling, they dragged me along because they wanted a game with my husband, and I was just part of the package. And it wasn't until, I want to say 2009 that I ever, you know, fortituded myself up, made the will save to get over that fear and sat behind the GM screen. And I ran Little Fears because since the rules were not, you know, there was one book at the time and there were so many, it was built more around the story rather than dice rolls and supplements that I felt like I didn't have to know everything. Cause the way every other GM's like, they could tell you a book and they could tell you what page and they could tell you what's chapter and they could quote stuff verbatim. I'm like, I can't do that.
Nah.
Yeah.
But you put me behind Little Fears and then I realized, okay. And I figured out since I've been playing with this group for a decent amount of time, I knew their out of character little quirks on how I could, I'm going to push that. Let's see what you do. Let's watch. Yeah. And since it's a horror game, they can scare themselves better than anything I do. So all I have to do is be slightly vague.
Yeah,
and they'll scare themselves. Holy crap! It's like you get a character. It's like, and I had already written what we were doing, and one guy, my friend Peter, comes up with this character, and he's scared of the shadows. And guess what monster I had already created the night before? I had no idea what he was playing. But there's a standard psychology. So pretty much, you know, lightning strikes, and the tree's shadows become creepy hands, and he freaks out, and while he is sitting at the table, you know, he pulls his shirt up over the bottom part of his nose, you know, so you can only see his eyes, like, I'm scared. So I'm like, yes. So I learned, it's like, all right, I'm not going to be able to be one of those, you know, hack/rules persons. Those games are difficult for me to run. But if I'm pulling on them some type of emotional fear, joy, that kind of thing, that I can do. Yeah. Oh, you find your strengths.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, I will go ahead and tell you what.
Yeah, of course. You're not letting you off the hook.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Come on, spill it.
I was introduced by a guy that I knew who was a year older than me, who had gotten his copy of they were the first printings of AT&T First Edition.
Sweet.
Neat.
And we had, at that time, there were only the Player's Handbook, the DMG, Monster Manual 1, and I think Monster Manual 2 had like just recently come out when we started. Like, it had not been out for very long, I don't think, when we started playing. It was a weird amalgamation of like Greyhawk and Homebrew. Now, when I say that he was a year older than me, he was a rip-roaring 9-year-old. You know.
Oh, yeah. Very, very, very old and aged and wise.
compared Drax. To 8 year old he was.
Oh yeah.
So I mean that's where I started. Now were we telling deep, meaningful stories about any no. It was kill this monster, take its treasure.
Hey, those were epic tales for you.
Yeah, oh gosh,
epic tales for you.
Yeah,
you know, and Robin Hood didn't have a lot of political intrigue when you first start reading the story. It's him doing all the cool, fun stuff first.
Yeah, yeah, and that's pretty much what we did.
It's awesome,
crazy, cool stuff because there were no rules. So you just I swing from the chandelier and I attack him with my assassination ability. Blah blah blah. Because of course, you know, I played an assassin at that time because you could do that sort of thing. Because that was an actual class in first edition.
They added it back in a couple editions later.
They did it as a prestige class in third edition. Mm-hmm. In second edition anyone could be an assassin.
Yeah.
That was the one nice thing that I do agree with that second edition had, where it was like, no, anyone can be an assassin, so there's no special rules on it.
Well, to be fair, it is basically a profession.
It is. It is. So yeah, and it was fun, and we had a blast, and we had a couple of the old school first edition, you know, modules. Like I remember doing White Plume Mountain and Expedition to the Barrier Peaks. I mean, I did all those classic adventures when I was like 9 and 10 years old.
Just not with the rules in mind.
Oh, no, we had the rules down at that point. Fair I mean, enough. We weren't playing. We didn't have big groups. We had like 2 or 3 of them. So lots of character turnover.
See, that's... I mean, and we'll get into that, too, again in a future episode. We keep putting markers for that. But, you know, I've barely ever killed my player characters.
Oh, God. These were the old school Gygax adventures.
Oh. Yeah, but even when the book says player characters should die, I still... You know.
Yeah, no, this was, I mean, dude, in Tomb of Horrors, there's an actual piece where there's a face of like this screaming demon face mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm. And where the mouth is, there's
annihilation.
Annihilation.
Yep.
And you put your hand in to reach for the thing and it immediately kills you. It's just the way those adventures were done. And I get it. I think they were great for what they were doing. But then it led to, you know, so who you were playing? I am playing Fighter. Okay. Can we have a little, who is he? He is the brother of Fighter. You know? You know?
Who is the cousin of Fighter?
Yes. I'm playing the fighter. After you've lost your sixth character, you just name him Fighter. And it's just how you pronounce it. I mean, it really got to that point. But after doing that for like, God, I think I played for 6 months. And I finally got my parents to agree to get me the original red box.
Old as the school.
Oh, nice.
And that had the stock setting of Maestra, which was pretty cool. It became that. In the beginning, it wasn't that. It was really just a very small section in the map. And that was all that it was. And then eventually that led into, you know, you had the blue box. The campaign world design was a very strange thing. And I do want to talk about campaign design at some point. And that is one to talk about because it's a very unique way of doing it, which is not the normal that we normally see nowadays, which is like top down.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see top down and you see bottom up. Those are the ones that are traditionally discussed. But the original ones were never done like that. They were actually done in something that was very unique. They were done where each adventure was in a different location and each adventure built on the area around it. And it wasn't just like this town. It was like this entire like countryside piece. So the background was all laid into the adventure and how it played out in these old school adventures. Nowadays they don't do that. Well, they're like, we've designed the world.
They actually had a setting in kind of the middle era of 4th edition. I'm trying to remember the name of it. where it was basically that type of thing, where they had these adventures that would describe the area around them, and it was this whole kind of, like, region of a world, but it wasn't part of any of their official lines. It was just this kind of special region they made.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Ah, somebody actually remembers that and actually started writing for it. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, the speaking of other podcasts, the Acquisitions Incorporated podcast with the Penny Arcade writers and artists, official D&D sessions they had basically were set in that setting.
Oh, nice. So, as you can see, we've all come to the game, like, to the game table from completely different ways. Jules is actually the most interesting because she did not start with D&D. She actually started with other things.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, I didn't play D&D until the new millennium.
Stay whereas, I mean, I remember when that's, you know, D&D was pretty much all there was, and then they started branching out it with some other games like Boot Hill, and I mean, I was too young to really be able to afford any of those, but I played them later on in life. But like Boot Hill, Gangbusters, the original Gamma World.
Oh yeah,
those were all originally.
Now see, I would actually I didn't play any game except D&D and Shadowrun until like 2000 or so.
Oh wow.
And also, it wasn't until Shadowrun that I actually played D&D, I'm sorry, roleplayed with anybody else who wasn't one of my brothers.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, because I didn't hit D&D until the new millennium. I've been reading, I mean, the Shadowrun books forever because I just thought they were neat, but I didn't actually get a chance to play until 2004.
That's actually kind of how my Shadowrun career started. Because I had picked up the... we had bought the Shadowrun SNES game, which, you know, I really dug. It was my favorite SNES game, still is. And we had seen the book for Never Deal with a Dragon in the bookstore. We kind of, you know, frequent it. And on the last page of the book was, "You've read the story, now play the game." And having fallen in love with D&D, you know, a year before, I'm like, there are other RPGs. Bought the second edition Shadowrun book, read it cover to cover the same day, never played second edition Shadowrun, because by the time I found people interested in playing, third edition was out. But I own a bunch of second edition books.
Oh my goodness.
I was dedicated. I just hadn't been there yet.
Yeah. It's, I guess, since I start out mostly, you know, my first gaming experience, and you know, after Star Wars, and then I did a lot of tabletop vampire and mage and werewolf and all that. You know, it makes sense though, considering when I first started playing, this was right after, like, the year after Interview with the Vampire dropped. So you know, that was pretty popular at the time. So more people were giving it a whirl. So I mean, I got to play a lot of the tabletop stuff. But yeah, you know, it's funny. I didn't get into like the D&D staples. It's like, heck, I played Rifts before I played D&D.
I'm sorry. No, Rifts is just a god awful game.
Well, it's not bad. I mean, at first, it wasn't bad. But then once we all realized the DM was an idiot and this is supposed to be a horror game, we kind of turned it into an MST3K parody of itself, which was kind of fun.
I didn't like the MMO either.
Yeah, pretty lousy.
Rifts. There has only been, as far as I can tell, there has only been a single Palladium system. I mean, yes, there are all these great systems out there, and that is something that you should look at. Look at all the systems. Use those quick start rules that we linked to in the previous episode. I'll make a link back to that episode so that you can look through some of those. And find something that everyone at your table is interested in. Because if you can do that, that will cut so much out of, you know, playing something and going, God, this is horrible. And don't be afraid to go, you know what? I'm not having fun. Are you guys having fun? Because if nobody's having fun, or, you know, only one person at the table is having fun, consider scrapping it and starting a new game.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know how many times I've suffered through.
Yeah, you don't get a refund for life at the end of your life for time wasted.
Yeah.
Death doesn't give you, it's like, oh, dude, I'm sorry.
Wait. But I kept all these receipts.
You can just throw them away, dude.
No substitutions, exchanges, or refunds.
But can I get store credit?
No. We don't do credit.
Shit.
Yeah, you better just pitch those receipts, man, and just stop playing games that suck or that you're not having fun with. And I mean, there are other shows that we'll talk about, you know, what is fun. Fun is whatever it is for you at the time.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be like giggles, but it has to be something. Right. It doesn't have to be fun and giggles, but if game's coming up and you're like, oh my God, I don't want to do this, don't.
Yeah.
I lost two years of my life because I was playing a game I hated. Not the players were bad or the rules. It's not my bag. It's not my style. It's something I don't like. And I did it for 2 years. I'm not doing that again.
Yeah. And you shouldn't. You really, really shouldn't. Because, yeah, no, I've been there before and I will never do that again. It's just, there's no need.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's talk about for use this evening. For use this evening. Oh, God, I really can't sing.
That's so bad.
And dear God, and I thought I was terrible.
I know, right?
No, I'm perfect pitch-ish. Well, it's relative pitch. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. No, I'm god awful. I admit that I can't sing with a damn. Not anymore. The for use this evening. This is where we will give you something that you can use in a game that you're running today. We're gonna start with jewels.
Oh God.
I know, right? So what do you got for us?
I hate you so much, Zendad. I hate you.
Well, see, we've all taken a turn being first. It's your turn.
I'm not used to going first. I'm short. All right. Well, the thing is that also if you're...
I don't even know how to take that.
We always had to line up either, you know, height or last name. And because I was short and my last name used to start with a Z, I was always at the end of the line. So I'm not used to going first.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, like, as a GM, the hardest thing is... corralling your players is very much like corralling cats. You know, sometimes, like, you think you made something obvious, or sometimes they just go off in a crazy direction. So I came up with the idea of the fun uncle slash big brother type of NPC. It's an archetype that can be a real boon to those new to a game, both running it or playing it. And this kind of a archetype can fit into almost any setting. The fun uncle slash big brother kind of character serves as a guide to the party without being ramrodded into the player's group, and which is becomes like a babysitter and it's annoying. It's not the, you know, exclamation point over the head, I am a quest giver kind of thing. They're used to give flavor and depth and kind of relativeness to the to your game. They can give advice on a quest, even reinforce your atmosphere. And it allows you as a GM to give hints to the players without being, you know, hey, look over there and pull that torch kind of a thing. It's, you can give like nice little hints. And the other boon to this kind of a NPC is they give you the ability to change not only the tone of your setting, but the tone of the group. If everyone's just been like steamrolling everything and they're getting cocky and overconfident, you can have like the fun uncle slash big brother pull up a chair of horror or dread. If there was a really emotionally draining scene, you can have him pretty much, you know, have him listen and give context and reference to what the players just experienced. And best way I've actually seen this kind of a character used was when we lost a PC and the player's kind of upset too. It gives a closure. You can have that NPC give a beautiful eulogy or lead the ritual where their name is carved into the, like, the Stone of Heroes kind of a thing. The one thing that this type of NPC isn't is a steamroller. He's not there to push the NPCs to do what you want him to do. He's there to ask questions and get the PCs thinking about stuff. And you see these in almost any genre. In Shadowrun, he's the retired runner turned fixer, dispensing like history and advice and sometimes weapon loadout. It could be the arcane librarian who knows the stories of the realm and the histories. She might know of an underground tunnel to get into the necromancer's tower. Or the babysitter who tells stories that not only show that monsters are real, but they can be defeated. Or the mech mechanic who is known for pulling wild and crazy stunts and then passing that knowledge off to new pilots. So there's a whole bunch, like, you can kind of get your players to think outside the box without beating them over the head with the rule book. It's a way to abstractly give the rules. So that's my contribution for this one.
Nice. Pretty nice.
Cool. Thank you.
All right, guys. Mine is actually really short.
Sorry.
No, that's great. I actually went pretty concise. And mine is also an NPC. He is, his name is Solofondus. He's kind of a down on your luck elven guy. So this is, think, more fantasy, but you can, the way I've got him written, he could play well in something like Shadowrun or, you know, any of these that have, like, those elements of mysticism or magic in them. You could theoretically fit him into anything like that. But he's a guy who kind of dresses nice, but all of his clothes have seen, like, better days. So they're kind of ratty, but they still look good. Sally is what he's known as in the darker parts of town since he's a male escort. And he can be found plying his trade in like taverns and inns that cater to the adventuring types. So he will, you know, he's looking for money and he will do whatever he needs to get the money. Now, while lots of people in his line of work will do things of a very questionable nature, morally and ethically, he's never been known to take advantage of somebody that he's with. So he's kind of like the, in modern normal things, you know, like the prostitute with a heart of gold.
Fair enough.
But this gives him, this gives him that layer of who he is.
Nobody's a robot except for the robot. You know, still a mostly mortal being.
Yeah.
You know, with a life and a past. So cool.
Yeah. Now, the rest of this is so you can fill in those blanks to fit into your setting wherever he needs to fit. But he's kind of that guy who can be there to offer that shoulder for the John, either male or female, whichever you want him to be. Because I am completely fine with diversity, and you damn well should have it in your game. Because our world has it, so it would be stupid not to use it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thousand different human languages.
Just throwing that one out there.
The only thing is, like, unless you're playing in a setting that adult kind of urges really don't come into play. And that they don't force it, because then it kind of makes things awkward.
Oh, it definitely makes things awkward. Oh, yeah. But
I'm using that as a nice term.
Well, we have an explicit tag in our show, so I'm going.
Fuck that then.
Most people are, as a general rule, that would listen to this are at least old enough to reasonably have these things in their game. So I'm not going to dumb this down for little kids.
I'm not saying that, but sometimes people, when they're trying to run a more mature game, misconstrue mature with sex.
Yes.
So just be careful about that. That's all. Yeah. It's
yes.
It is a pitfall, and I have seen it makes things very awkward.
Yes.
So
it's definitely something we can explore in a future episode.
Ding ding. Is, future topic.
that is a fairly large can of worms. Whether what level of maturity, whether it be sexual, be it violence, be it descriptive, be it horror, is appropriate for a game, and what audience and what settings are appropriate for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. All right, Justin, what do you have for us?
I think we're 3 for 3, Because NPC concept.
Yay!
Awesome. None of us talked about this before we did it. So this was literally all of us came up with something on our own.
Justin's a writer, so you know this is going to be awesome.
Wow, putting me on the spot. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I actually wanted to do kind of a series of characters. The kind of concept of the series is ally trickery, or allies to the players who have something to hide, or their appearance isn't quite what the party expects. The idea behind that is that player characters like to, you know, investigate things, like to see things beyond the veil, so it's always interesting to kind of give them something to look into, to give a world or a character more depth. So, today I want to talk about the Reborn Necromancer. Rebirth often brings about great change. Flesh may change, personality may shift, outlook may be reborn. The Reborn Necromancer could be an ally, but he has a shady past where they were a different person. Through the corrupt actions of their former life, they've had a chance to become something new, someone with different morals and outlooks than the dark entity they were before. In fantasy settings, they might literally be a necromancer whose rebirth brought not just a new body, but new memories, goals, and morality. Now they seek to redeem their actions and the life they've stolen. In science fiction, they switch bodies with someone. In contemporary fiction, they've taken the identity of another person and have left behind a criminal past. The NPC will always be happy to help the players, but they should always have the undertone of mistrust, of seeking to hide a darker secret. Revealing their past may cause them to return to that dark road, or it could even allow your players the chance to find redemption and to help them along their roads.
Nice.
Sweet. So, it kind of almost has the feel of, like, if you want to do, like, modern, like the guy got, you know, guy was in prison, was a bad dude, came out of prison and tried to make his life good.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
He's not ignoring, you know, he knows that, well, I wouldn't have become a good guy if I didn't go to jail first, but you don't want to, that's going to be fantastic. Yeah, I like it.
And this fills, you know, interesting roles, whether you have a guard who, you know, once upon a time raided this town, or, you know, someone who used to be a killer and has now devoted their life to healing people.
Or somebody that was a necromancer that pretty much was a good mage, and then he went down the dark path trying to do something good, and then backlash or a rebound or something like that. And
that's
then
a different character
it's like,
coming up.
No, but I had no idea who was going to do that. Sorry, everybody. But, you know, but after also experiencing that and going down that dark path, it's just like, all right, I don't want to know. I don't want everyone to know what I did. But no, don't do that. Bad things will happen. You know.
Yeah. No, this is, I like that. That is pretty cool.
That is brilliant. I love it. It's going to be fun.
All right. So
we're going to have like kind of write-ups on these things in the show's doobly-doo, right?
Yes, in the show notes. What those are called, the show notes.
No, not anymore. We have no show notes. We have show doobly-doos.
I'm sorry. It's
No, that's actually hilarious. So we're going to have show doobly-doos. All right.
If you agree.
I love it.
I can't wait to hear the next one, Justin. That sounds sweet.
All right.
I applaud that, sir.
Yeah, that was.
That's like slow clap.
All right. So next, what I think we're gonna do. Normally, we would be doing a lexicon with five words, but I think this episode has run a little bit long. So I think.
Sorry.
Oh no! Don't apologize. So I think this week we're just gonna do one, just a single word, and
doobly doo.
All right. Doobly-doo.
Oh, sorry.
No, doobly-doo is not the word. The word is actually polyglot.
Ooh.
It is an
I am
adjective.
One.
Yeah,
I
you
am.
Are. Now, the definition of a polyglot is... Jules, hit me with one of them.
Being able to speak multiple languages.
Yes. Also,
and speak and understand. Yeah.
Yep. Now, there's another one is there's actually like four variations on it actually.
Ooh.
Number two would be containing matter in multiple languages at once. So like a polyglot sign.
Oh, so kind of like the Rosetta Stone literally is a polyglot.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's pretty cool.
And number three is composed of elements from different languages. So that would actually be even more so that. Because that's actually like the Rosetta Stone would be elements from three different languages, how to translate.
Spiffy.
A better example of a polyglot sign would be...
pretty much what you mostly see a lot in Japan?
Yeah, where you've got stuff in English and Japanese like together on the same sign. That would be a better example of like a polyglot sign. And then the fourth definition is widely diverse, as in either ethnic or cultural origins. So an example of the word polyglot in a sentence. A polyglot community made up of many cultures, which makes no sense. But hey, whatever. It's just an example. It's not even a full sentence, but whatever. Because it defines it in the sentence.
That I kind of hate.
I know.
Oh, ooh, got an idea. On the when pretty much if you think about New York City and all the different, and they have Chinatown, they've got the Spanish area, they've got the Latin area and stuff like that. But they're, you know, in the big community, you know, in the boroughs, if you consider the boroughs one group, that's a polyglot.
Yeah. All right. Now, the origins of polyglot. It is actually from Greek.
Duh.
polyglottis. Which is from poly, meaning multiple, and glotta, meaning language.
Mm-hmm.
First known use is about 1650s. Yeah, we got a couple hundred-year-old word there. And that is lexicon for tonight, anyway.
Consider yourselves more educated, everybody.
More
congratulations.
Educated. Yes.
Hey, we still technically have four word definitions.
Yeah. Hey, don't say games never taught you nothing.
Exactly. Closing remarks and shout-outs. Who's ready to start?
Well, I will.
Okay.
So I'm trying to remember if I mentioned last week that I've been playing a lot of Final Fantasy XIV.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I am nearing the end of the first of the main quest patches, and it's been pretty interesting looking at their role-playing kind of storyline that they've been weaving into it. So... literally, before the session started tonight to record, I'm getting ready to do a quest, and it's like, hey, guess what? If you sit here and do this quest, you're going to be stuck here for like half an hour watching videos because it's the end of the stuff. And I'm like, oh, the payoff. Awesome. I'm going to view that later.
Yay.
Nice. So,
but I've been kind of enjoying it, you know, still having a good time with it. Digging this story, a lot of I don't want to say too much because there's a lot of spoilers in what I've been doing the last few days in the game.
Oh, but, yeah.
Yeah. No spoilers, please.
But to sum up, essentially they've been doing a really good job in terms of laying groundwork in, you know, the main game, and then the patches that came out a year later finally paying some of those things off.
Nice.
So, yay on full circle stories.
Awesome.
All right, Jules, what do you got?
All right. Well, I just finished, I call it crunchy reading because it's, you know, like a thing of Pringles. You can just put the whole thing in your mouth. I finished up the Memento Nora trilogy. It's a YA near future sci-fi novel trio. And it has it's like Memento Nora, Meme Plague, stuff like that. It's pretty much deals with memory and what happens when corporations get the power to influence people to have certain memories erased, you know, by your own volition. So they start causing things that people want to forget.
Nice.
It's pretty sweet. It's crunchy. It's not like super deep, you know, heady stuff like, you know, reading James Joyce or something like that. But it was fun. It was a cute little read. And, you know, I very much enjoyed that one. So, and...
write-up of, like, Eternal Sunshine on a Spotless Mind?
No, it's a little bit more. They take a lot of. It's kind of weird because they take a lot of imagery from the Matrix, the movies, and pretty much because the author really liked it, and it fit. It's stuff that, you know, like Buck Rogers and how that kind of permeated into our lexicon, and then that's where we get Duck Dodgers, and then over stuff like that, it becomes part of like the shared, you know, media history. So it's, you know, it's maybe about 30-ish years after The Matrix was out. Yes. So it's, yeah. So they actually use, you know, kind of imagery from that. Gets a little heavy-handed referencing later on, but big deal.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. You know, nice. And I, yeah, so.
Neat. Hey, Derek, how about you take us home now?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I am a pretty big Moon Knight fan. And
woohoo!
I know, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, earlier, I want to say it was last year, they had Ellis come in to write a 6-part Moon Knight series. And then they ran it out to like 13 or 14 issues. And then after the 6, Ellis stopped writing for it. And they brought in another creative team to finish it out. And then what happened was is you had Secret Wars started. And then after Secret Wars ended, they were saying, well, Moon Knight's going to come back, but we're not sure when. And 2 months ago, they just started it up again. And I've got I just started reading the first 2 issues, and it is so good. So good. And I don't know if they're going to keep doing it or if this is like a, because it's set right before the stuff that Ellis started writing.
Neat.
And it's going to pick up like right, it's going to butt right up against it, but it's done afterwards. Because when the last series for Moon Knight ran, it just ends and then it picks up like a couple of years later when Ellis starts writing it. It's years later.
Nice.
And it's basically trying to fix those holes.
They're filling in that gap a little bit, I think. And it's so good because it opens up with him in an insane asylum. And that's all I'm going to say about it. Go, if you like Moon Knight at all, go out and read the new series. And if you don't like Moon Knight, go out and read it anyway because I want more Moon Knight.
Nice.
Because these guys are getting it to where it's really cool. And I have a feeling that they are going to make it really work. So, yeah. Definitely need to pick that up. It is so good. So, but yeah, that's my shout out. Well, guys, it has been a blast. And next week, what is the show topic, Justin? Do you know?
You're about to tell us.
Oh, <Brent.
laughs> nice. Yes, I am. It's your first group. Putting together a group, guys. We're going to actually talk about it.
Oh, that's easy. Just have 3 brothers.
Right, we're going to talk about it the way the modern people do it.
Yeah.
So, all right, guys. Well, it has been a blast, and we'll take it out on the outros, guys. Have a fun one.
Bye-bye.
You too.
Bye. You can contact us or the show using Twitter, Facebook, or regular old email. Twitter accounts are, mine is at Zendead.
I'm at Jules Podcaster.
And you can find me at Null Operations.
And the show's Twitter account is at SeizeTheGM. You can email me at zended@seizethegm.com.
And me at jules@seizethegm.com.
And me at loperations@seizethegm.com.
We're also on Facebook. Find us at http://www.facebook.com/seizethegm. So thanks for joining us for this episode of Seize the GM. Feel free to leave a comment about this episode on our webpage, www.seizethegm.com. Let the dice fall where they may, and we'll see you again next week.
Seize the GM is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 4.0 International License. All copyrighted material references herein are held by their respective owners. No infringement intended, and no claim of ownership is implied.
Music for this show is from magnatune.com. Links to the artists will be in the show notes. Once again, we will see you next week.